to the political cesspool known worldwide as the South's foremost populist radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
And tonight, it is not James Edwards, but Bill Rowland hosting the show. So I've come off the bench to host the show for James, who had a social engagement tonight, but I'm doing my best to bring you a show up to the standards of the great James Edwards. Our next guest I can only describe as a legend, a man who has been a guiding spirit in the machine on the, I guess I could say, who has molded the thoughts and the instincts and the intuitions of the right for more than half a century. A man who has truly had influence beyond his own recognition of his own name and place in the history of political thinking on the right in this country. Our guest, Dr. Eustace Mullins, was an associate and a colleague of the great Ezra Pound. Dr. Mullins, welcome to the political cesspool. We are truly honored to have you on the show tonight.
I'm very glad to talk on this subject, and I have quite a bit to say about it.
Well, very good. And first off, I guess we'll go back a good number of years and mention that you indeed, I use the word colleague, but I would say an acquaintance, a friend, and someone who understood and knew the great American poet Ezra Pound, a man who is a giant of 20th century literature. Just a very quick study of Ezra Pound and your thoughts on him.
Well, Ezra Pound couldn't help but be a teacher. If you associated with him, you became a pupil. And that is inevitable by rule. And at the time that I met him, he had a very dreary existence as an inhabitant of an insane asylum in Washington, D.C. Well, you think if you've got to have an insane asylum, you may as well have Washington, D.C. as anywhere else.
Yeah, you could keep it populated all the time.
Oh, yes. And you got lots of material.
Well, now, what were his – do you know, have any idea of what Ezra Pound's were impressions of the post-World War II America were going to be? Did he have any insights into what would happen to this country after the Second World War and the emergence of the New Deal as a fixed part of our government, and obviously of the shadow of the civil rights movement coming into being?
Well, yes. Ezra was completely conscious of all the movements that were going on. And he wasn't particularly upset by any of it. And he had a good response to it. He kept track of it, and he watched what was going on. And he was never at a loss for words, I'm sure, because he had plenty of commentary and very pointed commentary concerning the Washington hoi polloi.
Well, give us some of the insights that Ezra Pound or some of the comments he may have made about the people in Washington or Washington in general.
Oh, yes. Well, Washington generally is known as a company town. It has only one business, and that is the business of government. There's no manufacturing, and there's a certain amount of retail business, and there are other facets of business which you find in other cities. But you're never overwhelmed by the activities of business, because business is a secondary matter there. And the people in that activity are never fooled or bemused by it, because they've learned how to deal with it. And it's an everyday fact of life. And so I found that one of my school instructors, a Dr. Rod Fleming, was visiting Ezra Pound at St. Elizabeth's. And he broached the subject to me several times that I should go and visit him. And I was a little overwhelmed by this because I didn't feel that I was qualified to debate words with the great Ezra Pound. And so I was a little offhand about accepting the invitation. But after a couple of months, he convinced me that Ezra was a person who were afraid to visit. They were unfortunately because they had been advertised by President Roosevelt as a mortal enemy, and Roosevelt, like the failings of most people, when you were an enemy, he wanted you to be punished and suffer for it as much as possible. And that was true throughout his political career. Partly that was due to his own inferiority complex, because John T. Flynn's famous work on Roosevelt made much of the fact that he was a political playboy and not a very serious person. And Flynn points out that Roosevelt's dealings with his staff and so forth were usually very incompetent. He failed to back them up, and when they got into trouble, he often didn't compliment them on their performance. And he simply was having a good time and enjoying life as president.
Well, as a wartime president, you know, he has been regarded as this paragon of courage and wisdom and determination to bring an end to the totalitarian regimes all over the world, except that in the Soviet Union, of course. Now, I'm aware that during World War II, Ezra Pound made some broadcasts from Italy regarding America's involvement in the war and Roosevelt in particular. What was Ezra Pound? Did he see this in Roosevelt, that Roosevelt was basically false, that he was, in fact, a man only interested in his own legacy or his own, as you say, good time?
Oh, well, I think President Roosevelt showed Pound a vision of himself, a happy warrior, and he instinctively thought of him marching off a war to defend his wife and children and shooting on the combat lines all day long. Well, that was far from the case. I don't know of any instance where Roosevelt ever fired a weapon in anger in his entire career. And his cousin, Theodore Roosevelt, Andrew, it gave just the opposite impression. He was very vigorous and combative and would stand up for himself at any time. And Franklin, on the other hand, was rather retiring and quite shy and not at all combative in any way. He actually avoided controversy most of the time.
Well, if indeed Roosevelt was shy and retiring and sort of a pleasure seeker, who in Washington was really the force behind the war? Who was really pursuing the war aggressively in Washington on behalf of the Roosevelt regime?
It was really the bankers and the munitions operators who were beating the drums for war. And they had two contestants in view, which were very attractive. That was Adolf Hitler in Germany. And
Mussolini.
And Mussolini in Italy. Who was always portrayed as the dictator. In fact,
Mr. Mullins, we're going into a break here. We'll be right back in just a few minutes, but please stay on the line. We'll have you back up in just a minute. You are listening to The Political Cesspool with Bill Rowland and guest Eustace Mullins.
All right.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
Don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood.
Please understand me, baby.
Don't let me be misunderstood.
Don't misunderstand me, baby.
Don't let me be.
Jump in the Political Cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the Political Cesspool, James Edwards.
Tonight, the Political Cesspool is hosted by Bill Rowland, as James has taken the night off and left it to the second string to take up the slack. But what a night we're having. Great guests. My guest on right now is Eustace Mullins, one of the legendary figures of the right in this country. We were discussing the Roosevelt administration, his relationship with Ezra Pound. And Mr. Mullins, now you, I think, one of your principal topics, one of the things that you are most emphatic about is the Federal Reserve System. Let's go with that.
Well, it was no accident that I got into this subject because my very first visit to Ezra Pound at St. Louis Hospital, we had a very pleasant conversation during the afternoon, and I got up to leave, and Ezra said to me, "By the way, Mr. Mullins, if you can get down to the Library of Congress, I would like you to look up something for me." And I said, "Well, certainly, Dr. Pound. Whatever I can do with that." He said, "Yes, I wish you could look in the files and see what you can find out about the Federal Reserve System." And this put me totally off course, because I said I had never heard of the Federal Reserve System. And there was no Federal Reserve System at that time, because the Federal Reserve System was nearly a gleam in the eye of Wall Street financiers. They hoped that Santa Claus would finally visit them on Christmas and leave them a Federal Reserve System that they could make a lot of money in. And so they had this dream for a number of years. Almost 300 years it had been going on. They had been working towards this goal, but not making very much progress. And all the Wall Street financiers, like J.P. Morgan and Isaac Seligman and people like that, were actually deeply engaged in this struggle, but so far they had produced very little of any real substance. At Bank of the United States in 1791, and the second Bank of the United States in 1831. And there were various furtive gropings toward this goal, but they hadn't really come up with anything solid, because there was a lot of opposition to it. On Wall Street itself, I think about half the bankers were openly opposed to a possible Federal Reserve System, because they felt that the dangers in there were too great for them, and it might create more problems than they were really equipped to deal with. So this was the case when I began my research into the Federal Reserve System at the Library of Congress in Washington. And my first setback was when I actually went to the Library of Congress, and I went to the economic section. And there the whole floor of heavy economic tones there, about the various aspects of finance. But there was no book of any kind or history or study of the Federal Reserve System. Well, that left me up in the air quite a bit. But I determined that the only way I could handle the situation was to buckle down to work and start from scratch and see what I could find out about the Federal Reserve System, which was exactly what Ezra Pound had asked me to do. And as I delved into it, I was agreeably surprised by the various amount of material on the subject. It seems that everybody in the banking field had a great interest in the central bank or private bank, and so I jumped right in with them and started following up the leads. And right away, I found that there was an ongoing conspiracy among bankers to enact their central bank. And I had to deal first with what is a central bank. And I found that a central bank had a very number of attributes which are readily recognizable. I found that the first thing, aspect of a central bank was that it was a conglomeration of banks which shared the resources and spread out the risks. That sounded pretty intelligent. And so, but the deeper I got into it, the more involved the spiderweb seemed to be, and the more complicated it was.
Well, now, let me ask you something.
That the central bank, that the main duty of a central bank was war finance. You cannot have a war anywhere without a central bank which could provide the financing. And so that was the very first thing I found out about the Federal Reserve System.
Well, who were the primary proponents and operatives in the Federal Reserve System at that time? Who were the men who were really pushing for the system or were deep in the operation of the Federal Reserve?
Well, as I began to examine the drive for a Federal Reserve System, I came up with the names of the Rothschild Bank. They were the principal leaders in the nationwide campaign for a private-owned central bank. And I found out that right away.
And, of course, that's a foreign bank. It's really a foreign bank.
Yes, it was out of Europe.
London, Paris, I think, Rome or Milan, various banking enterprises, but essentially controlled by the Rothschild family. And what influence at this point, this is post-World War II, what influence were they exerting over the American government and for what purpose?
Well, they had agents all over the country working in very devious ways, contacting public representatives and introducing various parts of a campaign for a central bank.
Well, now, if the establishment of the central bank was essentially to finance wars all over the world, then was this bank up and running, for instance, for the war in Korea? Was this one of the wars where the central bank would have had a particular interest?
Oh, yes. They would jump right into it and provide active financing for both sides. This is very important. The Rothschilds, as a banking firm, found that their most profitable activities was financing both sides of an war. In other words, there was no particular ideology behind their campaign. It was just practical, making certain that they, their agents were working with both sides and were providing the instruments of war. So that struck me right away as a Very important.
And we assume then that part of that financing would go, for instance, as you said, to the munitions industry, to making and financing arms and so forth. Is that how they made their money? Because obviously during a war, these materials get used up very quickly.
Oh, yeah. And they're very expensive.
Dr. Mullen, we have a break coming up. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these messages.
Oh, very good.
The Political Cesspool Guys will be back right after these messages. Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll free at 1-866-986-6397. We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place. Girl, there's a better
life. And you are back with Bill Rowland on the political cesspool. My guest tonight, Eustace Mullins, and Eustace Mullins has been discussing the Federal Reserve System, and he is broadcasting from the Federal Reserve Building. So he's actually in the belly of the monster right now. Mr. Mullins, welcome back to the show. As I said, we were discussing the Federal Reserve, and you were saying during the break that you were providing these reams of material to Ezra Pound on the subject of the Federal Reserve System.
Oh, yes.
And so in your studies of the Federal Reserve, that came up that the Rothschilds were basically the instrument of finance behind the Federal Reserve, and the purpose was to be war financiers, to create wars, to sell munitions and so forth. Well, where did it develop from the 1950s on? I mean, we can see the increase in hostilities between the Soviet Union and the United States and the ascendancy of communist China over nationalist China, and also, of course, the Iron Curtain and so forth. How did the Federal Reserve play into all of this, and what was their profit motive?
Oh, it balanced out very well because the people who were in it had to deal with the Wall Street financiers, and they often had to do it in a particular period where they're a little off balance on that subject.
Well, for instance, when the Korean War started, obviously these people have an interest in the outcome of that war. And then during the 1950s, of course, there is an acceleration in the development not only of nuclear weapons, but intercontinental ballistic missiles, bombers that can carry nuclear weapons virtually anywhere in the world. And an interesting thing happens as Dwight D. Eisenhower goes out of office. He actually mentions the dangers of a military-industrial complex. When he used that term, almost certainly unfamiliar to most Americans, that phrase, I should say, that the military-industrial complex, was he in fact referring to the Federal Reserve System and their play to make war, to make profit?
Oh, yes, I think that the representative on Capitol Hill had not encountered that particular problem before. But Eisenhower, as president, had come directly in contact and often in opposition to the activities of the military-industrial complex. And so therefore, that became something we had to deal with, that you had to find out what was going on. And Eisenhower was trying to warn us not to get dragged into too many things because of their activities.
Well, certainly, also during this era, we had Joseph McCarthy emerges as this strong voice against communism and the influence of communism in the United States, particularly in the United States government, and even in the United States military. And all the while, the Federal Reserve System seems to be developing in terms of manipulating the economy. So, I mean, what could be the relationship between the Federal Reserve, for instance, and the threat of international communism in the United States? It seems like that, let's say that the communists had prevailed, what would have become of the Federal Reserve System? Obviously, if America had succumbed to the Cold War, or had been the defeated in the Cold War, let us say, rather than the Soviet Union, how could the Federal Reserve justify its actions of financing war on both sides? Wouldn't the communist system have simply overthrown the Federal Reserve System?
Well, they couldn't really do that, because the Federal Reserve System was enacted by Congress as the economic arm of the Federal Reserve System. Therefore, it had a lot of different responsibilities. And I can go into that later in great detail.
Well, all right, tell us a little bit about the operation of the Federal Reserve System, not necessarily on a day-to-day basis, but in terms of deciding the economic direction of the United States, for instance, or the influence on the military-industrial complex, on international politics. Obviously, we say you put your money where your mouth is, and obviously they have the money to finance the mouth, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
So,
they have the money because they printed the money.
Right, because they actually control the paper currency.
Yeah, the question about paper currency had dogged Washington at the very beginning of these administrations, because no one quite knew how to fit it in. And the first paper currencies in this country were nothing more than scrip. a paper operation which passed for money, but which was viewed with considerable suspicion. And so they tried to figure out a way to sell this stuff when there was nothing there much to bolster it up.
Well, now, during the 19th century, there was some effort on the part of American politicians to sort of standardize a tangible and a reliable currency, either through, I know that there was the free coinage of silver on one hand, there was always discussion about the gold standard and how much the dollar was worth versus gold. There were silver certificates that were issued which represented silver currency. It is very, very tangible assets. But 1913, and that's a critical date in terms of the Federal Reserve, of course. How in the world did the Federal Reserve overcome our use of silver and gold as tangible assets and simply replace it with paper money, as you said, which has always been viewed with suspicion?
Well, this is a big step, and quite a few financiers were askance at the idea of the whole Federal Reserve System, because they couldn't see enough responsibility there to make them responsible for the entire operation. And that was hotly debated in the two-year debate that went on in Congress between Congressman Lindbergh, who led the opposition to it, and a lot of bankers like Jacob Schiff, who were a bit uneasy about the whole Federal Reserve operation, and they were reluctant to wholeheartedly endorse it. And this was proven by Jacob Schiff himself, who came from the household of the Rothschild bankers themselves. And Jacob Schiff came out strongly against the Federal Reserve System at a time when they were debating or to pass this law or to let it go into operation?
Well, as the Romans might have said, cui bono, who ultimately benefits from the Federal Reserve System? I mean, we talk about the bankers and Wall Street and so forth, but certainly behind all that, there must be a group or a clique or a club who ultimately benefit from a system that simply creates fiat money, that prints money and decides the value of money. And obviously, you know, there's a great deal of power in that if you can simply declare your currency to be worth something when it's not.
Well, I think it's a hard sale anyway, because you've got to sell to the public a paper currency that has no intrinsic value.
Right.
Well,
Mr. Mullins, we've got one more break coming up here in just a few seconds, and then we'll be right back. We've got you for one more segment here. Hold on. Eustace Mullins on the air with us, talking about the Federal Reserve System. We'll be right back with the political session.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life.
Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
Welcome back, friends and neighbors. You are listening to the Political Cesspool Radio Show with Bill Rowland. James Edwards is out tonight on fun leave, so I'm hosting the show. And my guest tonight, my very special and honored guest, is Eustace Mullins. And Mr. Mullins rejoins us for this last segment here, the last 15 minutes before the top of the hour. I believe we have Jesse, who has a question for Mr. Mullins. Jesse, what is your question?
Well, the main thing is that war is the main objective of the Federal Reserve. And to prove that point, I would like to ask Mr. Mullins, what was the very first act that the Federal Reserve did? What was the first act of the Federal Reserve?
Well, the first major decision of the Federal Reserve System, once it had been acted into law, was to make the astounding move of lending the British government $400 million in cash to start the First World War. And naturally, when you lend sums of that sum, that size, you're going to have more demands for more money later on. And you got to be ready to ante up the rest of the money when they call for it.
Number one ploy of the central bank is to create debt for a nation. Is that true?
Yes, it is.
And so when World War II had passed and the Korean War was a debacle, what was the next war that they created?
The Cold War and the Second World War.
But wasn't the Cold War the best war that they had created? It produced $5 trillion of debt for the United States government.
Well, I believe that the Federal Reserve System was responding in an arbitrary way, that they were willing to, they were printing money, and they were willing to respond with whatever sum is required. That meant that they had to keep up with making these very large loans and endangering the policy of the United States government by being overextended in these wartime loans. Now, I did not identify the circumstances under which the Federal Reserve System was producing the fiat money. And this is about the most important aspect of the entire thing, because this fiat money was being printed at the National Bureau of Printing and Engraving, and this was located on 14th Street in Washington, D.C. And the entire fiat currency was being printed by the Bureau of Printing and Engraving, and they're producing this fiat currency in response to these demands for more money. But the building that the currency is being printed in was located in the Holocaust Museum on 14th Street in Washington, D.C. And the circumstances where it was being printed in the Holocaust Museum struck a lot of people. That was very odd, because you don't expect a religious group to be involved in the wartime operations. And that has not been dealt with yet.
Okay, there's I guess you could say that whoever you owe owns you. So if the Federal Reserve is loaning money at a tremendous rate to either the U.S. government or another government, or making money, literally making money, printing money, then is the ultimate goal of the Federal Reserve to own the U.S. government and to own all the governments of the world?
Yes, that is what the world order is presently interpreted as being.
So the final objective of the Federal Reserve is essentially to control the money of the whole world, to control finances, I should say, of the whole world, even if it means controlling the world with useless money, worthless money.
Well, the money printed by the Federal Reserve is not by any means useless money, because they're well acquainted with working that kind of money.
So by even when the money is being printed to such an extent that its value is reduced to near zero, the simple fact that it's coming out of the Federal Reserve gives it usefulness, if not value.
Yes, so there's no sense of value there whatsoever.
So they just decide the value of the currency and therefore use it for their own purposes. They simply declare a value even if the money's not worth the paper it's printed on. Very much like the money in Zimbabwe, the Zimbabwe dollar or the Zimbabwe currency. Just the fact that they're printing it gives it the at least the impression it has some value, even if a wheelbarrow full of Zimbabwe dollars won't buy a loaf of bread.
Yes, that's true.
So ultimately, this has got to be, it seems to me that this must be a dead end for the Federal Reserve, because when the money becomes worthless, how do they control finances with worthless money? Is it just by, once there is so much debt, then there is no escape from it, that the Federal Reserve is the natural panacea for debt as well as for currency?
Well, the Federal Reserve has to deal with the situation which it creates. Now, the New York Times said a week or so ago that China and Japan had accumulated a Federal Reserve debt of $772 trillion. Now, that is a lot of money, a lot more money than this country has. So they apparently are going to work out something, how to handle this enormous debt.
Well, what of value does the United States Federal Reserve have to compensate for this debt? I mean, what of value do we have? We certainly don't have $700 trillion in gold and silver or oil or anything else. I don't know if we have $700 trillion in real estate. How do we compensate for that tremendous debt versus, as you know, in comparison to with our actual assets as a nation?
Well, they haven't really come up with any answers to that.
Well, what it would mean, doesn't ultimately that mean that both Japan and China will have to be impoverished by this debt? That is, they will be impoverished by our debt?
Well, they very well could be, because somehow the debtor nations have got to come up with a response to the Federal Reserve System of the existing debt. Have to acknowledge it.
And so, but I mean, the problem seems to me that the only way to resolve that kind of debt is to either impoverish one nation or the other. And by impoverishing the United States, certainly China and Japan have no hope of recovering that debt, and they become impoverished. Or we simply impoverish them by the fact that they have made bad investments in our economy. And I don't know what the Federal Reserve in that, you know, under those circumstances would have to lose. What do they have to lose by saying, we owe you this much money and we can't pay it?
Well, they haven't come up with that response yet. But there are other aspects of this situation also. The Federal Reserve is producing this debt in the Holocaust Museum, which itself has ritual implications. And somehow they got to deal with that.
So, in other words, there's more at work here than just dollars and cents.
There's a lot of ritual and ceremony and so forth which accompanies this, which has to be dealt with at some point.
Well, I wish we had time to deal with it tonight, Mr. Mullins. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We're down to our last few seconds. But I do want to say it's been an honor having you on the show. We were delighted to get you on to talk about these important issues. And we hope to have you on again in the future. Once again, thanks to Eustace Mullins, legend on the right. And we'll be right back after the news and these messages.
Installment of the Political Cesspool coming your way right after these messages.
Rising sun.